a founder, you have to do a million things. Where does communication sit in that ranking of a million things? Very often, it does not sit very highly because all the other things seem so much more urgent. But if you actually think around your communication strategy, it can be a complete game changer. So I would encourage founders to think about their story and what sets them apart and what gets people excited.
Welcome to Speak Like a CEO, the leading podcast on CEO communications. My guest today is none other than Jan Reichelt. Jan Reichelt is an entrepreneur, an exited founder, and today he's the founding partner and general partner of 10X Founders. And here on Speak Like a CEO, we want to talk to him about his experience in communications, and he has a lot, and obviously he's experienced a lot. So my name is Oliver Aust, and Jan, welcome.
Hi everyone. Thanks for having me.
Jan, so excited to have you on the podcast. So talk to us about your journey, right? So you have had a lot of interesting experiences along the way, just sort of to give people some context before we dive into 10X Founders and your exits.
Yeah, sure. So my background is actually more a technical one. In school, I was more on the tech side, and then I ended up studying business at WHU in Germany, which was a great experience. But I was lacking then a little bit the technical aspect during those studies. Also because I used to develop software previously. So I then went to the University of Cologne to the Department of Information Systems and tried to do a PhD in information systems, computer science. That did not work out too well because I figured I'm actually not a really good researcher. But instead, I tried to solve another problem that I had as a researcher, which was trying to organize my research papers.
Right.
And I did that together with a colleague of mine from WHU, Victor. And we wanted to initially just develop software and license this. And eventually it became a much bigger thing. And so that was my entry into the world of entrepreneurship.
And that was Copernio?
That was initially Mendeley. So it was a research collaboration platform that we developed and moved to London for it. I was actually based in London the last 12 years, and we started this in 2008, and then in 2013, Elsevier, the largest academic publishing company, acquired Mendeley.
Right. Well, how did you find message market fit? Because I'm assuming your target audience is also academics, and software and academics may not be the perfect match. So talk us through how did that work?
I think in our case, it was fairly natural because we were our own target group. So we knew how our target group would talk, how they would think, the problems they need. And then you're just genuine. You just talk to them the way you would talk to yourself, in effect. And that really actually resonated very well with the researchers. And eventually we were quite clever in terms of communication with Mendeley because we built an advisor program around the software. So in effect, we basically developed software, but I think we were kind of the start of the open science, transparent science movement back in the day. I mean, today it's more of a bigger thing, but back in the day it wasn't really. And so we designed a kind of an advisor program. We always communicated like our target group. We were very approachable. And I think that worked really well.
Yeah. What were the biggest learning in terms of communications when you built Mendeley to such a large company?
I'd say there are a couple of aspects. Like, one for sure is to actually do communicate, to take that seriously, to make that a point as part of your strategy. Another thing is to engage with your audience. And by engage, I mean not just talking to them, but talking with them. That is both online, that is through user testing sessions. We went to lots of conferences, gather feedback, take feedback into account. And there, we used a tool. I mean, today it sounds so simple, right? But back in the day, it was fairly new, in particular in our industry. Is a tool is called User Voice, where people could submit features that they wanted us to develop. And we would then have to take those into account because other people could upvote them. And eventually we would be forced to either say, okay, we're going to develop it or not. And we would have to develop a reasoning around it. But in any case, it was a channel to communicate with our users. And I think our users always really liked that type of transparency and that type of engagement. And that was part of our strategy, being really genuine, being engaging, being transparent, and also saying, guys, you know, thanks for the feature request, but sorry, we just can't build this given the other feature requests that are ranked much more highly. And that worked really well with our target group.
Interesting. And what happened then once you built the company?
Yeah, at some point, I think, well, first of all, I do think that the software we built and what we actually did was a big thing in itself already. So it really solved the problem. It solved a meaningful problem. So obviously the big companies in the space became aware of us and then also engaged with us. And we kind of built relationships with those companies, and eventually it led to the acquisition of Elsevier, of Mendeley by Elsevier. Mm-hmm. And that then obviously was a whole new level, because that's where I think learned how to communicate through a merger, through an acquisition, and the things that you need to take into account there. And Elsevier is a super professional company. It was the first time that I actually did a media training, which is super interesting. And I would, I think, recommend everyone after a certain size to actually do a media training. It's eye-opening. It's very, very cool. You learn so much. And, well, communication essentially became also a big strategy of the acquisition and also afterwards, because in order to make it a success, you need to communicate, right? You need to bring people along. You need to explain why things are the way they are, why things might change, might not change, what will change and why it will change and what we do and not do. And suddenly you are this small organization inside this big organization, and then communication is really crucial for both sides, because usually, you know, it's not natural partners. And so you need to make kind of each partner understand each other.
Yeah. And how big was the team at the time, and how did you communicate to the team?
Yeah, when we got acquired with Mendeley, we were about 50 people, and then eventually we grew it inside Elsevier to about 250, whilst Elsevier has thousands of employees across the world, but headquarters was more or less London and Amsterdam. And we communicated through various means. I mean, there was constant communication basically through us as the founders, obviously, and say also from the corporate side, the sponsors on the other side, obviously. But then we brought people together. We did kind of roadshows in different offices, internal sales meetings. We built work groups, so actually get people together to work together and not just talk to each other, but actually try to make them solve problems. And through that, they then speak to each other and communicate with each other. So various means, really. You need to be kind of really thinking around all the different ways that you can communicate. It's not just a one-off event.
Yeah, totally, right? Especially some mergers, acquisitions, different company cultures coming together, communication is absolutely key. And I could imagine Elsevier is a very large Dutch, I think, publisher and information business, and you as a sort of scale-up, probably different company cultures as well.
Yeah, indeed. But part of the acquisition was, in fact, that Elsevier wanted to have a little bit more of the startup mentality also inside their team. So I still remember these big companies that do yearly sales kickoffs in the beginning of the year to kind of really get the team excited about what's upcoming and in terms of features and new products. And I remember we did one in Southeast Asia in Singapore, and where we actually staged, we said okay, you Jan, you are the startup guy inside Elsevier, and you go on stage riding a bike, right? Because you're kind of the entrepreneur. And so that caught the attention of the people who were sitting there, usually, flying around in planes. And then suddenly there's the startup guy, using the bike to come on stage and then telling the story of Mendeley. And that resonated.
Sorry. You cycled onto the stage.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Yes, exactly.
Why?
Well,
to get attention.
Yeah, to get the attention.
To make a point.
To make the point that most of the people there were wearing suits, right? It was more the corporate environment. And nothing, not that I have anything against it. It was more like the culture that was there. Yeah. Very obviously focused on the commercials. And then I think in order to make that, engage that audience also, I think you need to think about how are you going to get your message across? And so it's kind of packing it into a story. And here comes the startup founder on a bicycle rather than, in the big car and also wearing a suit or whatever, Rolex and so on, right?
Yeah.
But instead, it's kind of the startup guy is now part of your company, and don't be scared, but actually engage. And I think that worked really well. So afterwards, many people were coming and saying, that was awesome, really cool story. And it empowers also people to talk about Mendeley in this case, and that's what we wanted. We wanted to engage that sales team to also sell Mendeley, right, to a global customer base.
I think that's brilliant. Was it your idea or?
I think no. Actually, I think it was suggested by someone from Elsevier side, which speaks highly of how they thought about it also. But obviously, I was all up for it, and it was a cool thing.
Totally. I'm a big believer in props, right? If you're on stage, you need props. And, you know, could go on for hours about good examples that we used or that I've seen. But just to make one example of someone who was on the podcast, Lisa, who the business was cookies, right? Cookies, virtual cookies. And she came on stage and threw cookies into the audience. Okay, let's talk about cookies, right? Because if she had got on stage and talked, okay, let me talk about my cookies and data protection. Not so interesting, but, you know, throwing cookies into the audience. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I'm listening. What's coming next?
Yeah, what I'm always thinking is like try to make it a story that people remember.
Yes.
Rather than just thinking about like one thing that you want to say. It's more like try to tell a story. That's the great thing about startups. Like I think startups have so great stories to tell. And so that's what founders should use.
But totally agree. I think founders are natural storytellers in the sense that all the elements are there, right? But often they don't unless they get help or are pushed. What's your experience?
Well, the challenge is that as a founder, you have to do a million things.
Yeah.
And so where does communication sit in that ranking of a million things? And very often it does not sit very highly because all the other things seem so much more urgent. But here's the point. I do think if you actually think around your communication strategy, I think it can be a complete game changer. It depends, obviously, a bit of the industry, maybe your product. But in general, I do think communication, if you do it well, both internally as well as externally, can be a complete game changer if you do it in a proper way rather than occasionally, right?
Yes.
So I would encourage founders to think about their story. And this is so unique and what sets them apart and what gets people excited. Again, both internally as externally, so customers, but might also be potential acquirer. They want to tell the story to their bosses inside the big company also. So the better your story is, the more power people you will be able to empower with actually what you're doing and the communication around it.
I love that. I mean, you're speaking from my heart, of course. But in Message Machine, the book Jack Singh and I recently published, where we talk about how communications can make founders unstoppable. It's essentially our core argument that if you get your communications right, if you move it from your last priority to your first priority, everything else gets easier. What problem in a startup cannot be solved by attracting more investors, more customers, or more top talent to work with you? And essentially, this is what communications for a startup or scale-up is about, attracting the right investors, customers, and top talent. And that's your communication strategy, as you just said.
Yeah. Though I would say there needs to be substance in the product, in the product market fit, because otherwise I think there's very quickly the risk that it will be perceived as bullshitting.
Yeah.
And I think bullshitting people will sniff out eventually.
Totally. I think we have bullshit detectors. I totally agree. I don't mean to say product is important. For us, it's that duality of product market fit and message market fit. And you need both. You know, you can't polish a turd, at least not for a long period of time.
Yes.
You know, you have a golden turd, but people still don't want golden turds.
Yes, correct.
So Capernaum, right? So you exited Mendeley, and after a while at Elsevier, you obviously, you know, the entrepreneurial itch struck again and you founded Capernaum.
Yeah, so Capernaum was a kind of a sequel to Mendeley. So Mendeley was more about research organization and collaboration, whilst I always thought like there's this other problem that researchers have, which is getting access to research in the first place. So only once you have a research paper on your computer, you can actually put it into Mendeley and do stuff with it, read it, share it, annotate it, cite it, and so on. But still, the problem was how to get the research paper, and that's because the infrastructure to access research papers in the research world is very cumbersome, or was very cumbersome. So even though you might have access through your institution, the technical means actually wouldn't give you that access because you needed to be logged into VPN or like some other sort of old infrastructure. So we developed a technology that gives you one-click access to research papers, similar to what you would experience in a B2C type of environment, right? I go to YouTube, I type something in and click play and I have it. So why do I need to go through all these hoops of different authentication, logins, and so on? That worked really, really well. And I knew if that worked from a technical perspective, we would have a case. And then very quickly, Elsevier's biggest competitor knocked on our door, who had already indicated initially an interest in acquiring Mendeley, but obviously that didn't work out. So then I used this like a little bit of obviously competitive dynamics, you know, being an entrepreneur, and plus Clarivate at that point, I mean, they had one of the biggest portfolio of products for researchers, including Web of Science, which is kind of the gold standard for research across the globe. And they then made us an offer to plug Kupernio together with Web of Science, make me responsible for Web of Science and a couple of other products. And that obviously was really cool because you could get Kupernio scaled up very, very quickly. It was an exciting position also for me. So we agreed to that. And to this day, I think Kupernio is one of the most downloaded plugins in the Chrome Store. I think it's now rebranded to EndNote Click, which is one of the portfolio products. But it was a really cool thing, a couple of hundred team size, $250 million in revenue or P&L. So it was very, very cool.
Yeah, yeah. And the size of the exit, has that been disclosed and who was exited to?
No, it has not been disclosed, but it was a very, very cool deal for all involved. And also, again, to this day, I think Clarivate actually did very well in that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main thing, right? So does the value increase for the company that takes it over?
Yes.
Did you stay on for a long time?
I stayed for the usual period and eventually left. Was also partially for private reasons. Wanted to change environment a little bit. And that's where I then reconnected also to some of the 10X folks here based in Munich. And everybody had a similar profile and a similar, let's say, desire to do more, to support startups more. And my view was that I had invested as a business angel. It was fun, but I was on my own and I like to work with teams and build teams. And so I teamed up here with the rest of the crew and we actually said, well, if we do what we do anyway, because we're passionate about it, right? Supporting other startups, entrepreneurs, we would invest in them anyway, and we are doing well financially, let's do it properly. And so we went to our network and raised a first-time fund, 160 million from about more than 200 individual investors, all also former or active entrepreneurs. And so are kind of almost like an entrepreneur VC, so to say, with a huge network in the back.
Yeah, that is fantastic. And it's a big fund. I mean, that's quite the number you have at your disposal. So what do you do with all that money? So where does it go? What are the founders and startups you're supporting?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you just zoom out for a moment, I think what we really want to do is that we really have this vision that we want to kind of network European entrepreneurs with each other and push through that, push entrepreneurship, European entrepreneurship to the forefront. And that's also because we went through all this ourselves. And hence, we believe we can contribute over proportionally in this regard. And so this is as much as it is about kind of investments, this is also about spirit and then the quality and the culture. And so we use the fund and investor structure, so to say, as a leverage to achieve this impact at a European level. And it allows us to basically be one of these top investors in Europe. We've done more than 300 angel investments previously before we actually raised the fund. So we've done quite a bit there. And so the vision is to bring this European startup ecosystem or the founders together, rope them into a valuable network, provide them with this kind of non-Googleable knowledge that you have as an experienced entrepreneur, provide them with the experiences that help these founders in their journey. And so we look at pre-seed, seed and Series A companies. We would invest usually between 250K and 2.5 million, but we are not dogmatic. We like to very much co-invest with other people, with other European top angels or top funds. This co-investment model really works well with us. We've even brought people together in our network to invest in startups where we as a fund have not invested because, you know, for various reasons it didn't work out. But still, we're fine if then within our network, people then still do invest. So it's kind of this network that's all based on this shared co-investment idea that helps everyone. And out of this emerges the network activity.
So that's fascinating. And the brand name, 10X Founders, why did you go with that?
So this was rooted fundamentally in the idea we didn't want to call ourselves something like da-da-da capital or so, because for us it was not so much about the capital, it was more about what the founders, and hence founders really became crucial to our name. But not any founder, but actually founders that have a 10X mindset, right? Either 10 times the ambition or 10 times better product or 10 times more speed or improvement and so on. So we combined this and it was fairly unique. Didn't exist like this before. And so it became 10X Founders.
Also to put the name Founders into the brand, right? Rather than Correct. Venture or capital. So usually it's about the capital side rather than the founder side.
Correct. That was very important to us. Like, I think we would consider ourselves kind of an entrepreneur-led fund. All of our partners are former entrepreneurs, have this big network based on our own entrepreneurial activity, the 300 angel investments that we've made, the 200 LPs that we have in our fund. So these are, I think, the two unique angles that I think we can bring and hopefully productively so.
So slightly left field point, but I recently read a book called 10X is Easier Than 2X. It's by Benjamin Hardy. It's not available yet, but I was privileged to read a copy, but it's coming out pretty soon. And I got fascinated by the concept, not just that 10X is cool and you want to have it. I mean, a lot of fun. I mean, great. You know, if you have that mindset, you go for it. But that's actually easier than 2X. And the key argument was that 2X just means you're pushing harder on the things you're already doing. It's just grind. Whereas 10X forces you to think completely differently. Is that, do you recognize this, that kind of spirit?
Yeah, I think it's more like thinking in step changes rather than incremental improvements. So on the one hand, obviously an entrepreneur needs to iteratively improve, but eventually the impact needs to be outsized. So the impact can only come through an outsized disruption or outsized improvement, a step change in how things have been done compared to they are being done now or supposedly done now. So I can connect to that, even though obviously the reality of the entrepreneur still is, well, you know, I have to look at that cohort and how is that cohort performing compared to the one last week. So, you know, it's a balance, but I think the mindset has to be, okay, how can I create a step change in what I'm doing rather than just get stuck in the day-to-day operations.
Yeah, I agree. It's easier said than done, for sure. And I'm not even sure it's easier, but it's probably not harder because sometimes incremental can be extremely hard and just, you know, becomes this just hard
work. And it's totally more motivating.
Oh, yes, I think that's, yes.
Yeah,
that's a really good point. Now, I guess a lot of founders, you probably get a lot of pitch decks, right? So you and your colleagues will probably be inundated by founders. Oh, please fund us, you know, please invest. What are you looking for in a pitch or in an approach for the, you know, the many founders listening to this?
Yeah, that's a difficult one because we're early stage investors and early stage investing, I think, is very far from trying to run through a checklist. So we look for X, Y, Z, right? It's not like this. And plus, given that we have a very entrepreneurial investment approach, we look at quite a lot. So we do not have a particular focus on industry or business model. But we really approach this from an entrepreneurial perspective and say, is there something that we feel makes a difference, will have an impact, can get big, is driven by people with ambition, motivation, skill, energy, and so on. So we do, in the end, we do look at a couple of standard things, right? How is the team? How does the team look like? What type of problem are they solving? How big is this problem? Where does this problem come from? Whose problem are they solving? Is that group big enough? What does the market look like? Is there technical defensibility? So we do look at a lot of these things, but we do not have, let's say, deal breakers, or we do not have red flags or anything. Like, we look at each startup and evaluate it based on its own merits. That is a lot of work, but I think it's also a very, again, entrepreneurial approach. And we're happy to talk to basically all startups that somehow match kind of our appetite for finding something that's a little bit odd.
A little bit odd. Okay, so that's interesting. Why does it have to be a little bit odd?
Well, odd in the sense of special, right? Where like this step change? Where is this step change? Where is this 10x in? Where can we see this 10x in the proposal that maybe founders making to us?
Yeah, how do founders communicate this ideally, that 10x ambition? Because it needs to come across somehow, right?
Yeah. Well, so there are different angles to this. Like, so I think this is very difficult to say this in one sentence. So I think it's like how you design your communication around what you're doing just in general. Then obviously there is a question of how do you engage with investors? Like, when do you engage? What do you communicate to them? And then there's like how to position yourselves in the market. So for example, what I found quite useful very early on in the beginning, at least it worked quite well for Mendeley and then also for Copernio, is we are the X for Y, right? Because you haven't defined really yet what you are. You will have to iterate, and it puts kind of a perspective in the mind of your listeners. And then over time, however, I think you need to evolve from you are the X for Y into defining yourself, and maybe possibly, if you can, define the category that your possibly opening up from scratch or that you're trying to occupy. And so there is an evolution in how you communicate about yourselves. In the beginning, I think it needs to be kind of really snappy, easy, straightforward. Don't create too many complex barriers in the minds of people that look at you. Time is very short for investors. And then again, think about how to engage with an investor. Is this just, are you going to try cold inbound, right? Hard to get that to work. Is this through a network? Is this because you meet them at the conference, keep them up to date about your progress, what you're doing, even if maybe in the first instance you got a rejection for investment? So you have to think through all of this. And there's no standard approach, I guess.
Yeah, it's getting that attention in the first place. So people actually look at the pitch, and that can be multiple ways. For instance, cycling onto a stage. Once you've invested, do you support founders with developing communication skills, whether that's customer communication, marketing, and so on?
Yeah, I don't think we are operational VCs in the sense that we would interfere, if I wanted to put it negatively, or support positively, like in the operations of a startup founder. I think our expectation for the founding team would be that, hey, we have to believe that actually you can do it yourself. And I think that's also the ambition that the founder should have. We can then support through the network. So if you need a communications expert, we're happy to look for someone in the network, connect you to them, and there will be someone in there, as there will be, I don't know, a fintech expert in Spain, or you name it. And then I think thirdly, the crucial point where we will help or will support, will be a sparring partner and challenge you as the founder, will be in the next fundraising process, where we will challenge, is your message clear? Because theoretically you would be talking to us also, right? That's kind of, I think, where we step in and say, okay, let's do a session, help you think through your storyline, connect you to kind of follow-on investors. And that is probably the point where, in the communications perspective, we can become the most active one.
Yeah, getting the message clear is so crucial, especially at that stage. Yeah. Also, I'm very interested. You have 200 LPs, you said, limited partners investing in your fund. So how do you communicate with that network, and do they communicate with each other? So it's quite a big group of important people, in time. So how does that work?
Yeah, so there are standard ways, the more formal ways, which is standard reporting, newsletters, and so on. But the way to think about this is it's not just like one network, but it's a group of people that support and like the way how we work and historically have done so and now can participate actually. And they've put their money down. So this is great. But then the way to think about this is that there are sub-networks in there, right? So there are some people, that like to do co-investments. Some people that like to do co-investments in fintech, for example. So we try to then get people from these different types of interest groups together. So for example, we do internal roundtables. When we invest in a startup, or let's say when we look at a startup, we would then share this with specific people within that network. Do you want to invest? What do you think? Would you imagine co-investing? Can you help? And then through, so to say, that substance, we create the communication. So it's not communication for communication's sake, but it's actually creating communication because there's substance, underlying substance, which is always the startup that we're trying to support. And that's where then people gather in smaller groups, or they do co-investments, or we have an expert session with them. We connect them to founders for sparring. And that's then how the communication actually happens.
Yeah. Okay.
And obviously not everybody communicates to the same extent, right, in that network. There will be people who are just happy investors.
happy silent investors and happy outspoken investors. That's a good place to be. talking about external communications, and I mean, you've been around the block quite a few times and seen a lot of things. You've done media training, you have given a lot of media interviews. What I observe is that a lot of founders sometimes believe that existing is news, right? Oh, let's put out a press release and tell the world we exist. What's your take on this?
Yeah, so this external communication is I think the main question that I would ask myself there is, again, coming back to what I mentioned earlier, is first of all, what is my story and why does this story matter? And everything will flow from there, whether it's internal communication, external communication, whatever it is. So I would always think, okay, what's the story? Maybe what's the change in story or the addition to that story? And why does it matter? why does it matter to me? Because hopefully if it matters to me, it will also matter to other people. So I wouldn't be thinking in terms of, let's say, okay, what's my next press release? Or I need to get an interview. But rather, I would try to think, what do I have to tell that really matters? And why does that matter? That's how I would start. And then I would try to get some social or factual proof around that. So, giving the example with 10x Founders, like the social proof is like we have more than 200 people believing in what we're doing. And the factual proof is that they have invested in what we're doing. So that gives the story of what I just told you decent credibility, I would say. And it is what people then will remember. And if I mention another time that we have 200 investors, right, then again, and this is coming back to my other point is think about your key messages, repeat them. Don't be shy of repeating. Like for me, it was always initially kind of people should have understood by now. But then 4 years into Mendeley, you would still meet people. Oh, Mendeley, what's that? Right. So keep repeating that in a nice way. Keep repeating your story. And suddenly this kind of becomes a story that has traction. And then you will have things to report. People will be interested. Like, for example, you said, hey, Jan, I like what I've heard. Do you want to talk about it? And maybe next time it will be a journalist and so on and so on. So yes. This is my view of how this develops.
Exactly. The more you tell the story, the more people will take notice and also interested to hear more about the story. And this is sort of the virtuous circle of communications you want to get into. And I like that very much. And I like these two questions. What's my story and why does it matter? And I use the same principle, but slightly different wording for the second question, which is why should anyone care? Mm, yes. So what question we sometimes say in communication. So but it's the same idea, I think.
Yeah, well, it is. I would say, why would anyone care? The first thing is, why do I care? That's how I, again, would start. Because if you care, you develop an energy, positive energy around it, that even if in the first instance someone else might not care, he might get or they might get carried away because you care so much. And then you can make them part of that journey, and then they will care as a result of that. So, but in the end, it's... hair splitting, so it's coming down to the same thing.
No, it's exactly. It's about the spirit of telling a story. Why does it matter to me? Why should other people care? So, totally. And it is not. Oh, we should put out a press release because we need sales or something like that, which is the wrong starting point. But it does happen, unfortunately. So, so in terms of internal communication, I wanted to ask you sort of your development as a leader. Obviously, you worked in different functions. Now it's obviously very different. So your leadership role has changed over time. So what are some main takeaways over the years?
So I think a couple of things that I've learned, I'd say, is that with communication and leadership, which is indeed closely connected, I think it's important to stay calm, stay reasonable, and also consider the other side, like how would they perceive a message? What do they want to hear or not want to hear? It also doesn't make sense to drum your message down the road if really the other side really doesn't want to hear it right now. So you need to find an angle of how you can get your message also to the other side. And then communication is also not just verbal. It's kind of how you feel, how you behave, how that reflects on how you interact with others. So communication is also nonverbal. It's visual. If you look stressed, if you come into the office smiling, these are two very different ways of how you can communicate. And that's something that I learned and I would consider. And then to me, the three things are always be clear what you want to say, think about your two or three key messages, and then don't be shy of repeating those. So this is, stuff I would say that I try to do more, then obviously it's not always easy to really stick to this, but trying to internalize some of these things helps.
Yeah, and in order to deliver that, you obviously need at least a little bit of preparation time, and I think that's also sometimes lacking, that people try to wing it, and obviously the message doesn't come across well, and they don't come across well, and that's sometimes 5 minutes, 10 minutes can make the difference between a message that lands and a team that's engaged and aligned, and a team that doesn't think the boss has kind of lost the way or doesn't really know what direction we're taking. So it's 10 minutes well invested.
Absolutely. I think it's good to also write things down.
Like, yes.
What is your vision? What is your, how do you want people to communicate about your startup?
Yes.
Which empowers them in turn, right? So they feel more comfortable saying actually what maybe they should be saying. Hopefully it makes them proud and so on.
I think it has to be written down. I think that there's no way you can just communicate that verbally, because we take a lot of companies through that process, and it just clarifies so many things and it answers all the questions. So it's a very valuable process. In a previous conversation, you mentioned to me that it's not just about how you communicate as a leader, it's also empowering others to communicate. And I love that. I think that's, you know, that's the spirit of entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is important. I think it can never just be unidirectional. It cannot. I mean, it's not good communication if you just, you know, always send your message to others and not take into account what they think or how they feel or whether they believe it or not. So I think that doesn't work. I think good communication means always two-way. You need to also show that you are interested in feedback, that you work that feedback into your messaging, that you engage, as I mentioned before, you know, with the user voice example in Mendeley's case. But it's the same internal, right? I mean, let yourself get challenged by the team, because better they do it than the market, right? So, and it will also create more buy-in. And then the other thing is, again, I think the more it is a story rather than a list of facts, the more natural it will come for people to also tell that story rather than list the list of facts. And so I think the more powerful it will become.
Yeah, totally. And I think as a leader, you have to lead by example, right? And do that. Do you also give sort of media trainings or specific coachings and trainings and communications to the team or the founders in order to facilitate that process?
So we don't, at least not yet. But given obviously, I mean, it's also because we're like only running since a year and a half or 2 years. Yeah. I think it is an important point in our thinking, let's say. We're not doing anything yet. Right now, as I mentioned, we'll connect them to experts in the network, you know, give them some general advice. But certainly something that we're thinking around possibly doing a little bit further down the road to equip people with some basic training around communications. How can we do that? What's the best way? Make people aware, think about, or give exemplary communication strategies. So, yeah, it's something we're thinking about, but not doing
yet. Yeah, something further down the line. Anything else in the future on the horizon for 10X founders yourself? Anything you can or want to share?
Well, not yet, I would say. It's still a bit early. I think we are, you know, in the middle of our first fund. It's a great fund so far. I think the amazing thing is that we're able to work with so many great startup founders and then co-invest with some of the greatest investors in Europe already. So this is pretty cool right from the start. It's a lot of fun. And I hope the startups also benefit from it. And then we'll see how we'll do fund number two.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jan. It's been a blast talking to you. I'm so impressed. And also shout out to my friend Garrett McGowan, who's put us in touch. Yeah. And you were on his podcast, and Dries as well, the VHO podcast, most awesome founder podcast. So shout out to them. That was also a very good conversation, touching on different, more sort of on the business building side of things. So if you enjoyed this conversation with Jan, I would strongly recommend you head over to the Most Awesome Founder podcast and also check out the episode with Jan over there. I always close with this question. What is your best piece of communications advice for all the listeners out there?
I mean, on the highest level, I guess it's, as I said to you earlier, is to actually take it seriously and think about what your comm strategy, and by that I mean verbal, nonverbal, visual, the culture and so on, what your comms approach is, right? Because that can be a game changer if you do it well. Don't let go of it, right? Because it's such a huge opportunity, and ideally you and your team, you want to shape it, and you don't want to have it shaped by others or by coincidence. And then I guess on a more practical level, as I said, if you get a chance to do media training, I would highly recommend that. I think it's money and time very well spent. And then the basics, think about the 2 to 3 ideally genuine key messages, and don't be shy of repeating these.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. Thank you so much. Jan Reicher, the founding partner and general partner of 10X Founders and accomplished entrepreneur, exited founder. So thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening. And Jan, thank you very much for being here and taking the time. I know you're a busy guy, so I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for your nice words. Thanks.